Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Please take your seats quickly, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. On today's Tour Catch-Up,
Iga Swiatek snaps up her fourth straight title in Stuttgart.
Carlos Alcaraz beats the rain in Barcelona.
And Wimbledon bans Russians from this year's competition.
Kim, today is the 25th of April and we are here to catch up on the week in tennis at Passing Shot HQ, especially backed by our crowd funders, Julie Tharp and DR. It's been another eventful week on the tour, both on court and off court. I feel like the news from Wimbledon this week has really put a spanner in the works, particularly for Russian and Belarusian players. And it's sort of overcast, I think, all the great tennis I think we've seen on the tour, with the clay season fully in now, fully on the road to Roland Garros. I mean, where's your head at? Have you been able to kind of focus on the tennis? Because I feel like my brain has sort of been just thinking about all of the ramifications of the Wimbledon announcement earlier in the week.
Yeah, a lot of fallout from that decision, a lot of controversy, lots of debate. So we'll definitely be able to sink our teeth into that in the second half of the show. I think that's kind of distracted me, I think, from some of the tennis that's been going on this week. But we will give, you know, the likes of Carlos Alcaraz and Iga Swiatek their moment in Passing Shot Sun. We will get on to
Anastasia Potapova as well.
Oh, and Andre Rublev, not forgetting all our champions. Yeah, we'll get on to the results from the last week first and then have a good old, you know, analysis of that decision by Wimbledon, which, to be fair, a few weeks ago, like, I think you had sort of said that you'd heard rumours and mutterings that it was going to happen. So it wasn't maybe a complete surprise.
I feel like, though, like back then, I thought we were sort of laughing it off as like, no, they won't really do that. And then they sort of have, and everyone's, yeah, it's taken a real, you know, I think, you know, obviously a real serious turn. But yeah, it's a real juicy subject, a real controversial subject, a real divisive subject as well. And yeah, we'll get onto it in the second half. But let's start, Kim, with the tennis. Let's start in Barcelona. The Barcelona ATP 500 event. Carlos Alcaraz is your winner. He beat Pablo Carreño Busta in the final, in an all-Spanish final, 6-3, 6-2. I think the final was a bit of a blowout, if I'm being quite honest with you. But yeah, it was a tournament that I think perhaps will probably be remembered for just how much rain there was and how many times players had to kind of double up. Alcaraz in particular had to play semi-final and final on the same day. I thought he was going to be knackered, Kim, for his final. His match with de Menor, which probably was his final in one sense, because he was so close to going out. He saved match points. De Menor really should have been able to put it away in two sets. But I thought Alcaraz was going to be knackered for that final against PCB. And I thought PCB, you know, he's a wily competitor. He's experienced. He'll know how to exploit Alcaraz's his tiredness, you know, given the amount of running he's had to do through the tournament. But no, Alcaraz 6-3, 6-2, really routine victory. PCB, for whatever reason, just didn't turn up, despite having a much easier semi-final. But yeah, very impressive from Alcaraz. We all know his talent. And again, throughout this week, I think particularly against de Menor and Tsitsipas as well in the quarterfinal, it was all on show for the home crowd.
Yeah, and PCB afterwards said it wasn't the match that he expected. So maybe he had gone into it thinking, oh, Carlos is a bit tired. He's played 3 hours and 40, you know, earlier on that day against de Menor. But, you know, Carlos Alcaraz,
maybe he just felt he needed to turn up.
Yeah, maybe it was a walk in the park, but not the case, because Carlos Alcaraz is, you know, a young 18-year-old, clearly very physically fit. So I'm sure that long match earlier in the day, you know, wasn't wasn't perhaps the same impact as it would have been on an older player or what have you. But yeah, great win for Alcaraz. He's four titles to the good now. He's actually won the first four finals of his career all in straight sets. So I was thinking that's the complete opposite to someone like Felix Auger-Aliassime, who was basically like the complete opposite. But yeah, I think what's really interesting is a lot of parallels again with Rafa. You know, Carlos is now in the top 10. And Rafa did exactly the same thing after winning the Barcelona Open 17 years ago.
Spooky.
So yeah, Alcaraz is now the youngest player to go into the top 10 since Rafa did it at this exact tournament and stage of the year back in, what, 2005. So yeah, the parallels continue. but I mean, aside from that, obviously, you know, there are obvious differences. But yeah, great win for Alcaraz. He came through some tough battles, also managed to defeat Tsitsipas for the third time in his career. He's never lost to Tsitsipas. So I think much to the annoyance of Tsitsipas, there was a few controversial moments with the umpire, wasn't there, Joel, in that one?
Yes. I mean, Tsitsipas probably felt like that match was him versus the world. And well, namely Alcaraz and maybe the tournament organisers. But yeah, it was a very sort of aggro-fueled match from both sides. Particularly, I mean, surprise, surprise, again, Kim, Tsitsipas, we're talking about toilet breaks. He was getting angry, particularly at Alcaraz, because he had, I think it was seven and a half minutes or so off court. Tsitsipas was basically saying to the umpire, Alcaraz is sort of taking the mickey a little bit. And the umpire did nothing about it. And yeah, it's the moment sort of got to him. It really kind of angered him, and it also felt a little bit kind of tactical in terms of there were moments in that match where Tsitsipas was in the full ascendancy and Alcaraz was just kind of trying to use his time, similar I think to how kind of Tsitsipas has sort of used toilet breaks previously. And I think he just got a bit of a taste of his own medicine, to be quite honest, and he did not like it. It was a really enthralling match, really entertaining. Alcaraz, as you said, does now lead the head-to-head between them 3-0, which I feel is quite surprising. But yeah, that was a very tense match, and you know, they're gonna obviously have a lot more matches in the future, and I wonder if this sort of aggression that we saw in this match will carry over into their kind of matchups in the future and keep it heated, because you know, it was from both sides. And also, you know, at the start of that first set as well, or sorry, the end of that first set, Tsitsipas just leathered a ball straight at Alcaraz's head, and he did not like that one bit. So yeah, there's plenty of needle there that I would expect to kind of spill over into future matches in the tour, probably towards you know, going on, maybe, who knows, at Roland Garros or even further on into the clay season.
Yeah, well, we love a bit of grudge match, you know, action, don't we? I'm not on the ATP tour. Yeah, love a bathroom break aggro. Yeah, definitely Tsitsipas and the toilet definitely seems to be.
He told the umpire, you should be fired.
Yeah, he said he accused the umpire of not knowing the rules, essentially, because, you know, the umpire had given Tsitsipas a penalty. But obviously Alcaraz took a prolonged break at the start of the third set as well. And Tsitsipas said, if you are wrong, you should be fired. So not, you know, I think players have said worse. You know, I'm thinking of the likes of Kyrgios. But yeah, they do always sort of seem to have the umpires' jobs on the line when they get angry in matches, don't they? And I mean, yeah, obviously these rules are kind of new. You know, they have had to be recently implemented. So at least they are kind of being called upon in these instances, and you know, it's going to be frustrating. But Tsitsipas, you know, like we've said before, you have got to keep calm and cool. You cannot let these things get to you. And I know it's easier said than done. We all get frustrated about things, but you know, it's the ones that can really contain it that generally will be getting the win. So things to work on there for Tsitsipas for sure. And Alcaraz, he will go off to Madrid and Rome and hope to win more titles on the clay. Yeah, really great week from him. He got the massive trophy, as we were saying last week. Who was going to get that big trophy and go in the swimming pool? And yeah, Spanish win on Spanish soil. So nice for the home fans as well.
Yes. And we also had, Kim, I've got to bring this up, my favourite German all doubles pairing, Kravitz and Mies, winning their first title, I'm assuming, since getting back together. 10-6 in a championship tiebreak against Kulhoff and Skupski. So I'm a bit excited about that. But yeah, it was a good tournament. But yeah, it was just a shame. There was just so much rain and it just felt like it impacted on players' performances. And from a British point of view, I mean, Cam Norrie, he came from a very, very long match against Fucsovics to get to the quarterfinals. And he was just felt like he was dead and buried against de Menor, who came through in three sets, but Norrie just ultimately, I think, ran out of steam in that third set. Nice to see de Menor actually get to an ATP 500 clay event semi-final. I think he will be kicking himself that he didn't get to the final. I think he will have a few nightmares about the shot he had, the forehand shot he had mid-court, Alcaraz seemingly out of sight, and then he got done with a passing shot winner. I think he will be a bit frustrated in terms of not being able to close it out, but still a very good week for him, I think, to get to a semi-final and be amongst all of the clay specialists like Alcaraz, Schwartzman, and as I said, Credio Buster as well. So, yeah, good week for de Menor.
I think I had Schwartzman and possibly PCB down to do something at either Monte Carlo or prior to that. So I'm glad that both of them got to like a semi-final and final, because they were sort of names on my radar over the last few weeks. But yes, Alcaraz victorious in Barcelona. We also had the Serbia Open out in Belgrade, which obviously headlined by world number one Novak Djokovic with all his home fans, home country, second seed Andre Rublev. We had a final between the two of them. I don't think Rublev had ever beaten Djokovic before. Certainly hadn't beaten an active world number one on the tour. Very interesting final between these two. 6-2, 6-7, 6-love to Andre Rublev. Kind of running away with it in that last set. Djokovic just could not compete. He was gone. He'd ran out of gas by that point. And yeah, very well-deserved title for Rublev. Apart from dropping a set in his third round, you know, pretty smooth all week. And then obviously that set dropped to Djokovic in the final, which, you know, they had a really, really long end to that second set. Djokovic was, you know, able to come through in that tiebreak. But yeah, by that point, even despite taking a bathroom break at the start of that third set, Novak had nothing left in the tank.
Yeah, and I mean, just on that, does that worry you for if you're a Novak fan, the fact that, again, you know, because it's quite similar to the, you know, the match against Davidovich Fokina, where he just ran out of steam, it felt like, in the third set and not really had, you know, much else to give. And I think he's acknowledged that in press, saying he had a kind of non-COVID related illness a few weeks ago. And I think that sort of depleted him of his energy, and he's still kind of working his way back. But the fact that he doesn't sound like he's got the energy levels to go best of three. I know we talk about, you know, peaking at the right moments, and Djokovic will obviously want to peak at Roland Garros, but the fact that he's not being able to be competitive, I feel, over even just three sets, I don't think is, I still think, like, yes, he got to the final and that's obviously a big improvement on Monte Carlo, but I still think I'm looking at that final set and thinking, yeah, but there's still quite a bit of work there to be done.
Yeah, I think though he had a really like tough week in the sense that he was a down a set in all of his matches and had to fight back. And, you know, that does take its toll, doesn't it? And I think that's what he referenced after the event. You know, he could very easily have gone out in that first match.
Yeah,
you know, he was down a set to László Zsér, like fellow Serbian, and had to come through in two tiebreaks in the last two sets. And then down a set against Kecmanovic, another fellow Serb, down a set against Kachanov in the semi. So, you know, not a walk in the park. And if, as you said, coming back from this kind of illness he had, it is going to take time. So if I'm a Djokovic fan, I wouldn't be worried yet either. I think there's still two more tournaments prior to Roland Garros, and I think he's going to get better each week.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, I watched some of the Djokovic-Kachanov match, and, you know, sets two and sets three, that for me was the closest we got to kind of the Djokovic clay court player that we just sort of associate him with. You know, he was playing very, very well. Kachanov didn't really have much of a response to him. And I think if there are a couple of sets that Djokovic looks back on from this week, I think it will be those two in terms of the intensity he brought. And yeah, just kind of just being very dominant and very aggressive. But as you said, at times it was just about getting it done, winning ugly. And it didn't really feel like, you know, the Novak Djokovic we know, you know, going down a set, you know, three times in a row. I know that, you know, even Djokovic fans, you know, will say that was probably not in the game book, but at the same time, they will probably say, you know, minutes on court, getting, you know, a run out is, again, a part of the process. And he'd certainly got a lot of minutes, I think, you know, at the Serbia Open. But when he's coming up against someone like Rublev, who's been in very good form this season, yeah, he just didn't have enough, I think, intensity to bring it across the full match. And I think still, for me, that is the biggest challenge that he's got, is can he be competitive, not just at the start of the match where he seems to be kind of losing sets and he won't want to obviously make a habit of that, but also how he's finishing as well. And if he's able to kind of claw it back, does he have anything left in the tank? And from the match against Rublev and from the match against Davidovich Fokina, I think the answer at the moment is no.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? Because it's so unlike what we're used to seeing from him. And I was watching that last set of my mum.
It's so comprehensive, though. It's not even close. It's
my like... mum was like, has he eaten gluten or meat by mistake? Because he's so out of sorts. It was just like, what is happening? But, you know, it's been an interesting year for him, hasn't it? Yeah. All that hoo-ha.
It can't have helped.
No, because even when there's sort of things playing on your mind and you've been through that kind of struggle, it's just weighs you down physically. At least that's what happens with me. So you can kind of almost feel just sluggish in your whole body because of an experience like that. So give it time, Djokovic fans. He's too good a player not to obviously come back and be back at his best. It just might take a bit longer than perhaps we thought. We also had Dominic Thiem, though, didn't we, Joel, in his first outing back. He lost in the first round to John Millman. So not great, but, you know, three sets it went to. And I think Thiem is playing this week in Estoril. So he'll be looking to kind of go a bit better there. But I think, again, he's been out for so long with injury, it's going to take time. And he needs that kind of space and patience to do that. But I mean, one player who definitely is just timing everything brilliantly and getting everything spot on at the moment is Iga Świątek, women's world number one. She won yet another title. I think four on the trot. This makes it her 23rd straight match win. And she won the Stuttgart Open, the Porsche Tennis Grand Prix, 6-2, 6-2 over Aryna Sabalenka in the final. I mean, she had a tough semi-final, but the rest of the week was, you know, straight sets, pretty comfortable. And yeah, she's just on fire. It continues. It's she's now up, I think, it's the longest win streak, I think, since Serena Williams back in 2013. She's had, just astronomical amount. Oh, I apologise. Naomi Osaka last year went on a 23-match win streak, but over a longer period of time. So Iga Świątek's won the same number of matches, but in a shorter period. Yeah.
And it doesn't look like it's going to stop. I mean, it's really impressive seeing, you know, Świątek on court at the moment. She looks like the world number one. And, you know, it's got to a point where if someone takes a set off her, even that feels like a massive achievement, as did Samsonova do in in her semi-final. And it felt like she played almost like the perfect match, and she still couldn't kind of come away with it. And I think, you know, for Świątek, I think what was so impressive was, yeah, she's been kind of got that capacity to kind of blast opponents off the court, but also when she is in a dogfight, like in that semi-final, and it might come down to a point here or there, again, she's coming through those with flying colours. And when she gets to the final, again, she's just so imperious in finals. Her record is, is exceptional. And Sabalenka's record in finals is also very good. I think she's only lost twice in WTA finals. But Świątek was able to just assert her game on the court, and Sabalenka just didn't really have an answer to it. Particularly, I feel like with Świątek's direction of the ball, you know, short cross-court shots, particularly on the forehand, moving Sabalenka around. It just felt like it was only going to go one way. And it's quite scary, Kim. I feel like we're already sort of talking about Świątek as, you know, obviously there's still quite a bit of time up to kind of the French Open. But at the moment, you've got to say, it's hers to lose, no, on the WTA Tour?
Well, she's already won this tournament and she is now, you know, a vastly improved player from when she won it, you know, kind of 18 months ago. So, yeah, by far and away, she would be the absolute favourite. Having said that, you know, sometimes players go in as overwhelming favourites and maybe the pressure gets them. I mean, she obviously works for that.
I keep thinking Dinara Safina, Kim.
Yeah, but I think Świątek doesn't seem to suffer from Dinara Safina's sort of nerves. You know, yeah, she works with a sports psychologist. She's very calm, you know, mentally, physically. Like she said after that Samsonova match, she was able to just like reset for the final the next day and just kind of start again, focus from scratch. So really impressive yet again. The fact also that she has won her last seven finals without dropping a set. I mean, she barely loses games in her finals. So,
I mean, her coach wasn't even at the tournament, which again made it doubly impressive. And I think, you know, also, I mean, just watching her, it was interesting to see her movement because it felt like that court was a bit of an ice rink. I'm not going to lie. There was a lot of sliding going on that court. A lot of kind of players, I felt like, falling over, kind of twisting and turning. So, I think it wasn't not necessarily an easy court to play on. And perhaps the speed of it as well maybe played into someone like Sabalenka's favour, because she came through some quite difficult opponents. She even beat Kontaveit indoor. She snapped Kontaveit's streak, beat Badosa, the second seed, the world number two, in the semi-finals as well, and also beat Bianca Andreescu in three sets. So, you know, she had a very tough route, I think, to the final. And even with the conditions, which I felt were maybe in favour a little bit of Sabalenka, given, as I said, it was a bit faster, and I think that played into Sabalenka's power game from the back of the court, Świątek really just, had an answer to it. And it was... Yeah, it was not. It was a bit of a formality, really, and it doesn't feel like there's many weaknesses in the game at the moment. Maybe all the players need to ask Ludmila Samsonova what is going on, because apart from her and Emma Raducanu, you know, that was not necessarily a regulation straight sets victory. She did kind of challenge her at times. It feels like between them, they were the only two that really got close to kind of upsetting the apple cart. Or should I say the bagel cart of Iga Świątek?
The bakery, yeah. I mean, Emma had a respectable scoreline, 6-4, 6-4. She did make Świątek work a little bit harder than some of her other matches. And I mean, the last time I think they played was in the girls' singles back in 2018 at Wimbledon. And Świątek only lost one game in that meeting. So obviously they've both come a long, long way since then. But Raducanu, pleased she got, you know, two wins under her belt. I think this was her first official, you know, WTA event on the clay. So, you know, it's still a very reasonable performance to lose to the world number one.
I think more than reasonable. You know, she applied herself very well. I didn't even think she was going to play it, given the, you know, the blisters and the toenails that happened in the Billie Jean King Cup qualifier. So to see her even taking part was great to see, and you know, winning back to back matches as well. And then giving Świątek a really good game, run for her money. I think, you know, she showed, you know, what it's going to take. And particularly, I think with some of her shots, I felt maybe her serve, Raducanu's serve, was at times being just kind of played with on a string by Świątek. So I think there's certainly things that she can work on. But I mean, as you said, first WTA Tour event, 500 event, no less, on indoor clay. I mean, I think she applied herself very, very well, and I'm certainly excited to see how she kind of goes on. We'll see, you know, what she can do in Madrid. But it looks like, it's not just, you know, we should be thinking about her on a grass court or a hard court. It certainly feels like she's got the game that can be applied to all surfaces. And I think that is the hallmark of a really, really good player, that sort of lays the foundations. And I think going on later into the clay swing, I think she could cause a few upsets potentially.
Yeah, for sure. And you know, once she's in Grand Slam mode, things can be quite different, can't they? So let's finish with our weekly Emma Raducanu roundup and touch upon the Istanbul event, Joel, because we had a WTA 250 out in Turkey. First time winner, actually. I think this is the first-time winner of a WTA Tour title so far this year. I feel like last year we had loads already by this time, but we only had the one this time this year. Anastasia Potapova winning 6-3, 6-1 in the final against Veronika Kudermetova. Two Russians in the final, obviously not representing Russia at this time. It was pretty comfortable, really, for Potapova in that final. She was down a break in the first set, but then won 8 games on the trot and, you know, only lost one after that point. So, really fantastic for her. She's a very up-and-coming player back in a few years ago.
Yeah.
Wimbledon champion.
She was up in like the 60s, pushing like top 50. And I think she had like ankle surgery. And she fell out of the top 100. So it was really nice to see her, I think, kind of getting back and rediscovering her form, coming all the way through qualifying. I was looking at some of her results this season. I mean, to be honest, she's not really done a lot on the WTA Tour side of things. So I think as a fan, just looking at it, it was a little bit of a surprise if you go by the form book. And she had also lost to Kudermetova at the start of the season in Melbourne as well. So a little bit surprising in that sense. But really nice win for her first WTA Tour title. She's, I'm sure, over the moon about it. And against someone like Kudermetova as well, who's, again, had a pretty, I think, solid season, quite a dangerous opponent. Good win.
Yeah, and as a qualifier, obviously, even more impressive. I think second qualifier this season to win a title after Tatiana Maria a few weeks ago in Colombia. So, great stuff for Potapova. You know, she has been former junior number one in the world. So, she has good prospects, but we've kind of not really
forgotten about
seen
them.
Her, because of her injury. So perhaps this will be the start of the next phase of her career. So, we wish her well. And I was very impressed she managed to beat Sara Cerebos Tormo in straight sets. No long kind of 3-hour battles with Cerebos Tormo, as we come to see on the clay. But quite a straightforward week, really, in that respect. But that pretty much sums up the results for this week. We'll be back after a quick break, talking about all of the fallout from Wimbledon's announcement that they are going to ban Russian and Belarusian players from the championships. Andy Murray has also decided to play some clay events, and Ash Barty has started playing golf. So we've got lots to discuss. Do not go anywhere. Welcome back to The Passing Shot with Joel and Kim, sponsored by DownloadTennis.com. And let's move on to a little fun segment before we get on to the more serious stuff, shall we say, Joel. We've got a par for the courts, as usual. And I think, like last week, it was quite difficult. There was sort of an easier and a harder bit. This week, I hear it's even more difficult. what are you thinking?
It is even more difficult. I actually dropped a little bit of a hint as well in the first part of our episode. It is quite difficult. So because I'm being in a benevolent mood, I'm actually going to give you some lives. I don't think we've ever done this before, but because it's so difficult, I'm going to give you three lives, so you can give me three wrong answers before you're kind of fully out before reaching par for the courts.
I feel like a cat, Joel. You're giving me lots of lives.
Exactly. Okay. Think of it like that.
Great.
So, are you ready for the topic? You're probably like confused. Like, what is it? What has Joel got up his sleeve for me?
I can't think of what you might have mentioned earlier. So, what is it?
Okay, so my topic for you and our listeners for this week's Par for the Courts is Annette Contaveit's streak of 22 wins and 4 titles on indoor courts has come to an end because of Aryna Sabalenka. In those 22 wins, she defeated 18 players. And my par for the courts question for you is, how many of those 18 players can you name? They occurred across St. Petersburg, Moscow, Cluj, Ostrava, and obviously this week in Stuttgart. So 18 players. I think it's very, very difficult unless you're an absolute Contivate fanatic. So I'm going to set the par score at, with three lives, I'm going to give you 6 out of 18. A third is okay. What I'm looking for.
Yeah. I think that's doable because essentially I'm probably just going to have to name players in like the top 20, 30, 40. I'm just trying to think who she would have played in finals. Yeah, this is definitely the hardest one to date. And I'm not going to lie. I'm not a closet Contivate. I don't know if any of our listeners are, but good luck to you if you are at this attempt. Okay, right. Let's get started. Let's kickstart this one off then.
Okay.
Guest number one, Paola Badosa.
Correct. Yes. Badosa is on the list. So, yeah, that's one.
Maria Sakkari?
Correct. Yes. She actually has defeated Sakkari twice, but she is on the list. So, yeah, she also, I think, beat Sakkari in one of those finals. So, yeah, Badosa, Sakkari, two. You've got four more to get to par for the courts.
Now, I want to say a particular person, but I'm not sure if they would have. I think they might have played the Cluj event because it was their home. I want to say Simona Halep.
Correct. Ooh. Yes, that is correct. I think she beat Halep in that final in Cluj, but it is correct. So yes, that's three. So halfway there.
There was definitely this person I'm thinking of who I think actually beat Contivate. But maybe that wasn't indoors. Well, they had a few matches at the latter end. Garbiñe Muguruza? I think she might have beaten her and then Muguruza beat her back.
Correct. Yes, oh. Muguruza. Kim, I shouldn't have given you any lies by this point.
You should have made par score much higher.
No, I should have, shouldn't I? So that's Muguruza. So Badosa, Sakkari, Muguruza and Halep. So you're on four.
So, I want to say, I mean, there must be loads of random players that she would have played in like the first round, but I'm going to say someone like Petra Kvitova.
Correct. Oh! Yes, Kvitova is right. Yeah, Kvitova is on the list. So that's five. So you need one more to get par for the course. And I gave you three lies, which seems really silly, which seems really, really silly now.
Now, I feel like I should say a player we've just mentioned, actually, earlier in the show. Oh, this is where you kind of come unstuck. So I'm going to say Veronika Kudermetova because I feel like she might have got to quarters at some of these events.
Kudermetova?
Especially two of them were in Russia.
Incorrect. Oh. Kudermetova not on the list.
Okay.
That's one of your lives gone. Ooh, it's getting tense now. Oh, I know.
Just trying to run my head through like rankings. Oh, Belinda Bencic.
Belinda Bencic?
Yeah, I'm sure they played.
They actually played twice. You are correct, yes! Kim. So, yes, Bencic, she defeated twice as part of her streak of 22 indoor wins. So you have achieved par for the courts. Well done.
I've achieved it thanks to one life. So yeah, thanks for that additional helpful.
I know. Otherwise, you would have fallen at the last hurdle. Which I feel like we've been in that situation a few times before.
We have. I had to really cast my mind back. You know, it's sort of at least 6 months ago now, wasn't it? Well,
yeah,
six months. I don't know.
Any other names?
Well, I was going to say, out of interest, who else is on the list? I was going to say maybe like, I think Pliskova was out actually, wasn't she?
No Pliskova.
Oh, no, not Andreescu.
No Andreescu.
Maybe someone.
No Anisimova.
Not Osaka.
No, Osaka.
I don't know. Was Raducanu involved?
No, Raducanu. No. Shall I, do you want to? Do you want?
Kerber Fernandez.
Kerber is on the list. Yes. Okay. She beat Kerber actually this week in Stuttgart.
Oh yes, of course. Okay, tell me the rest.
You could have had Sorana Kosteja, Paola Badosa, Belinda Bencic, Petra Kvitova, Siniakova, Andrea Petkovic, Garbiñe Muguruza, Marketa Vondrousova, Alexandrova, who she also beat twice, Krunic, which would have been very tricky, Alison van Utvank, Kalinina, Rebecca Peterson, Simona Halep, one of the passing shots' favourite, Kim, Jill Teichman, Yelena Ostapenko, Maria Sakkari, and Angelique Kerber. So those were your players. So yeah, listeners, let us know how you did. I was quite, Kim, I'm not going to lie, I'm pleasantly surprised how well you handled that, because I thought that was very, very difficult.
I'm going to go and treat myself with a nice like hot chocolate after we've finished or something. well, anyway, that streak's sadly over. The next part of the court will have to be Świątek.
Yeah, I know. It was genuine, Kim. I'm not going to lie. I was genuinely was thinking about that. And who knows? Maybe that will come up at some point.
I'll get revising now.
But I don't think it's going to be an episode anytime soon.
Well, we'll have to see about that. Right, we've got a mailbag quickly, Joel, before we get onto the deep stuff. This is from Jenny on email. So thanks for getting in touch, Jenny. She's asked that with the following ATP and WTA Netflix documentary that's being filmed, throughout the tour, she's asked which players outside of the top 10 would you love the documentary to follow and why? So have you got any thoughts on this one, Joel?
Yeah, I would go for someone like, I'm thinking like characterful, has good personality, has good energy, he's good vibes only, even though, you know, when he's on the tour, yes, he has a few decent results, but sometimes, you know, he goes through a little bit of a lull. I'm going for Francis Tiafoe.
Yeah.
I just think, he's just like I just think he's a real nice personality, and I want to see more of him on my TV, and not necessarily on the tennis court. I think he's just got a very good outlook, I think, on life in his terms of his worldview, and just feel like he makes friends wherever he goes. So I think he'd be quite an entertaining guy, I think, to follow. And I'd go for someone like a Tiafoe. I was sort of thinking whether there is an opportunity to just have the insight of a sort of, I don't want to say journeyman player, but a player who is more kind of like doing 250s in the first round, second round, and sort of just made their way onto the tour and is just sort of existing on it. But I don't think that would make as thrilling kind of documentary content as, yeah, perhaps like people at the, you know, the topper end of the rankings.
Well, I was going to say you could ask Paul Bettany to get back into his, was it Peter
Ooh,
Colt?
Peter Colt. Ooh.
He was a journeyman before he randomly, did that film. I know what you mean. I think that would be a real interesting insight, because I think what we've seen with the Drive to Survive and the F1 series is they do focus on like the teams like Haas and, you know, who aren't up at the top and they don't have the budget and they're kind of struggling to get by, and it's a really fascinating insight, and I think it actually creates a lot of warm feelings towards those at the back of the grid or lower down in the rankings. So I mean, in terms of personality, someone like Bethany Mattek-Sands, like,
oh, that's a great shout.
She's a great laugh, isn't she?
Yeah.
Although I don't know, is she actually playing anymore? I think she's sort of, I'm not entirely sure. And then I think, you know, I mean, well, there's so many players, I think, that we don't really see enough of them, so it's hard to know like what they actually might get up to. I think there's so much that we don't see that I think anyone, to be honest, would be quite interesting to kind of follow. I think, I'm quite a fan of Dennis Istomin, as you know, and I think he would
Netflix would really love that. Let's make a global superstar of Dennis Istomin.
Everyone loves his glasses, Joel. I think, you know, he could be a model for that look. So let's let's move on. Jenny, great question. I'm still thinking of players, actually, because I think there's so many avenues you could explore. But I do hope that this documentary does follow quite a variety and not just like Tsitsipas or whoever. I think the more the merrier, almost.
Give me Jill Teichman.
Yeah, I hope they don't neglect players who are lower down and really, you know, struggling to survive. I think it's really important to tell all stories. So there we go. Thank you very much for getting in touch. If you've got any more questions for the mailbag, do give us a shout. Always happy to have a crack at answering them. Now, Joel, let's move on to the announcement that we had, I think Wednesday, just gone, from the All England Lawn Tennis Club, that Russian and Belarusian players have been banned from competing in this year's championships. The LTA have also banned them from competing in any grass court events, I believe, happening this June, prior to Wimbledon. I mean, a lot of players have come out saying this is a ridiculous decision. Djokovic said it was crazy. Both the ATP and the WTA have said that this needs to be thought over again because it goes against the rules, essentially, or the principles of both organisations, that, you know, individuals should not be discriminated against or prevented from participating based on anything but their merit. What was your initial opinion when you heard this news?
Yeah, it's a really divisive issue, I think. You know, there are some people out there who are totally for this. There are some people totally against it. I think what's kind of interesting is I think we're getting to a point now where you can't be a neutral. It feels like you have to be on one side or the other. And it feels kind of very split. And, you know, the gauge on social media, I think, has been, you know, more kind of swaying towards kind of negative kind of sentiment. And I think, you know, if you do look at it in terms of, you know, those Russian players who, you know, like Rublev, you know, writing on the TV camera that, you know, he's, you know, he wants to, you know, make peace, not war. And, you know, from that point of view, you feel kind of really sorry for them. And you do think this is kind of an unfair kind of situation. But I think when you look at kind of Wimbledon and their kind of point of view, they must be thinking along the lines of, you know, accountability. And it, from their point of view, I think they think, regardless of kind of what players' standpoints are, what their views are, they, in their eyes, are accountable. And I think I was thinking more kind of about, you know, situations that could arise at the championships if nothing happened. And let's, for example, say there's a Russian player, maybe it's Medvedev, or if it's Rublev or Sabalenka, I don't know. But one of those players wins and lifts a trophy. You just know that that would be used as some sort of propaganda in some sort of way by Russia, by Putin. And I think Wimbledon and the gatekeepers of Wimbledon are sort of thinking and reflecting on those scenarios that could potentially happen if they do nothing, and think, we can't let ourselves potentially get into that situation, because that would not be, you know, a good look, you know, for the, obviously not, it would not be a good look for the tournament. So I think they're protecting their best interest by doing this, making this decision. No, it was, they probably knew when they were going to make it, that it was not going to be a universally popular decision, but they felt like they had to make a call on it. And I think what's interesting is that they have been the first tournament to come out and say this. And, you know, they are in a powerful situation because they are a Grand Slam. They are steeped in history and players want to play it. And yeah, the ATP and WTA, they could look at sanctioning Wimbledon. And there's potential talk at the moment of them taking off the ranking points for Wimbledon. But I just think that, you know, it could lead to other tournaments following suit. I mean, there's already talk of the Italian Open being pressured by the Italian government to do something similar. It does kind of create Pandora's box in the sense of tournaments going off and doing their own thing. So I would like to see some sort of unilateral stance, but I think it's quite difficult. And I think Wimbledon have gone about sort of wanting to protect their own assets and protect their own image come the championships, and they're doing it with enough kind of time in the build-up.
I think what struck me was that it's very piecemeal. At the moment, it's only Wimbledon doing this. Mm. And the way that tennis is governed, you know, you've got the Grand Slams and they kind of operate quite independently. They don't even obviously follow the same rules between the slams, like they're four independent organizations. And then you've got obviously the ATP and WTA. So I'm not sure about the Italian Open, how they would implement this, because surely the ATP would be the ones saying you can do this or you can't. And from what they've come out and said in light of Wimbledon's decision, that surely they wouldn't allow the Italian Open to do it. Obviously, Wimbledon hold a lot more independent power and perhaps the most powerful out of all the Grand Slams. And we may see other tournaments following suit. What I think is absolutely ridiculous that we have this situation where the French Open, these players can play, they could win that title, lift it, and, you know, win however much in prize money, have their kind of face plastered all over the newspaper. Yet, you know, a month later at Wimbledon, they can't. Like, if you're going to make one decision, it should be uniform across the board, because it just creates this kind of almost hypocritical standpoint. And I personally, I totally see the point that obviously should a Medvedev or Sabalenka win, you know, Putin could use their success as propaganda. But the other side of it is that by banning these players, Putin is also using that as propaganda, this kind of them versus us kind of standpoint. And, you know, this anti, like, obviously he's extremely anti-Western, but he's already using this decision as a kind of, oh, look at the West and how awful they are, they're banning all our people, you know. So it's already being used, it can be used kind of both ways. So, and I also think, you know, yes, it can open up maybe other tournaments wanting to follow suit, but it also opens up a lot more questions when you start to prevent individuals from competing. You know, we've already seen the fact that they can't compete in the team events, which I think is completely fair, but when it becomes like individuals, you know, these individuals don't operate, they don't play for Putin. They're for most, you know, situations, these are individuals who often don't even spend time in Russia. They're traveling around the world. They often have grown up and lived in other countries from a young age. You know, they a lot of them have kind of come out and made some sort of like anti-war gesture, like you're talking about Andrei Rublev. But there are limits on what they can also say, because they've got family back in Russia. They have a threat of actually what they can and can't say. You know, they've got to look after their families as well. And I know there's been some Ukrainian players who want Russian and Belarusian players to have to sign like a statement or disclaimer to say that they completely denounce, you know, Putin's actions and Russia's actions and the invasion and, you know, the regime. And they want them, they want these players to kind of officially denounce that to be able to carry on competing.
I mean, that's just officially denouncing your citizenship, in my view, to Russia. Yeah, so that would be a very brave.
Yeah, exactly.
That would be a very brave unlikely move.
Yeah, I think that's a bit much almost, because you're putting your own,
you're putting these players at risk potentially.
Exactly.
If you force that kind of ultimatum on them. I don't personally want to see that. I think, you know, again, another sort of angle on it is, I think this, you know, this debate I think we're having particularly at the moment, and I think this is kind of, it's not just happened now, but it's happened with Russia because of, you know, the Olympics and doping, etc., where, you know, we've spoken about these tennis players in terms of, well, do they represent their country? Do they represent Russia, or do they just represent themselves? And I think that's kind of a grey area, I think, in tennis, in the sense that, yes, we've kind of banned Russia from team competitions and we've let individuals kind of go on. But, you know, when you see the players on TV and you've got their flags next to their name and, you know, we hear national anthems, it's hard, I feel like, it feels hard to separate those things. And for me, as a result, yes, this war is being led by Putin, but of course this is countries at play. And for me, it's kind of, you know, Russia have invaded Ukraine, and the, you know, tennis players, sports stars, you know, are Russians. And unfortunately, you know, some people will say that that kind of connection there. They don't want, they don't feel like, you know, they should be allowed to kind of play on the tour at the moment. You know, Svitolina, Kostyuk, all the Ukrainian players are coming out and voicing their approval of this decision from Wimbledon. So it's very difficult. It's really kind of split opinions, and you know, there's going to be kind of fallout from it. Again, I think players, because it's so individualistic, again, there's already kind of talk, I know we've spoken of in the past about the PTPA and some sort of union, and whether there's a potential maybe for players to stand up for other players in terms of a boycott. I don't know how realistic that is, but you feel like there's not enough infrastructure maybe in place to perhaps do that in a way that is effective, unless there was some sort of independent, maybe PTPA-like kind of body. But yeah, it's very difficult to kind of see where this is going at the moment, because it's just kind of opened up a big can of worms, hasn't it?
Yeah, I also, you know, people are questioning like the effectiveness of this. You know, banning these players from playing Wimbledon isn't going to change what's happening in the invasion and the war. I personally don't think the fact that Rublev may not be able to like do well at Wimbledon is going to stop Putin from invading, you know. But I guess it's, obviously that's very basic to think that it would, but it's all part of like, it all adds to this like wider bigger thing picture. That's going on. Yeah. Although other sports, you know, there's other sports that are still allowing individuals to compete. So I think if a big sporting event is going to do it, there needs to be a really joined up, like unified action taken across like all sports, not just like one tournament from one sport, because that's just like one drop in the ocean. Is it really going to make?
Yeah. And I do wonder if Wimbledon kind of thought, you know, given their power and their role in tennis as a Grand Slam, and, you know, they generate a lot of money to kind of, you know, they're a big kind of cash earner as well, whether they felt like they needed to be that person who was going to make that first commitment, that first sort of hand raise, and see if others kind of follow suit. And again, we might be in this situation where other tournaments do follow suit. They're maybe even not waiting around for, you know, the ATP and WTA. As I said, there are rumours of the Italian Open doing something similar. I don't know how realistic that is at the moment, given how close we are to the tournament. But it's not a surprise, I think, to see these sorts of situations arise, because do you remember, Kim, we had the French Open just sort of go out on their own and say, hey, we're gonna run our tournament in September or October, because, you know, we need the money and we missed out on it because of the pandemic. And I think this is kind of Wimbledon's own sort of stance, and yeah, maybe took some people by surprise. But given, I think, the tournament this summer and the potential scenarios at play, yeah, I think they're just being very kind of obviously risk averse and not letting it up to chance and up to the draw, and are getting ahead of the game. So yeah, it's a lot to take, isn't it? I feel like we could do like a few episodes at least on the subject.
Yeah, I think when you first said a few weeks ago that they were thinking about doing it, I just thought, oh, you know, what a load of old tosh, like that surely can't be the case. And then I think when it was announced, I mean, my initial thing is I disagree with it, because I don't think individuals should be, I don't want to say punished. You know, I'm aware that there's a war going on and there's awful atrocities, and obviously the whole of Ukraine is being punished.
I think we shouldn't lose sight of that, given all of this information.
But I do think that, I guess from my perspective, it's sort of like the argument of kind of like whataboutery. It's like there are other countries in the world who are aggressive. Like their governments are aggressive, or there have been wars in the past, or there may be wars in the future. So if this is happening now, do we then therefore mean like is Wimbledon, would they ban other players from other countries should future conflicts happen elsewhere? Like, is it going to be consistently applied going forwards if there are other conflicts and whatnot? Like, you know, you could kind of argue things from a multiple of standpoints to justify kind of removing certain people from tournaments. So I think it's like I know that sport operates within the realm of politics. It's impossible, I think, to completely separate the two, but this is obviously a really direct intervention into sport as a result of the political landscape. And I'm just not sure I'm entirely comfortable with it.
And I mean, you talk about not feeling comfortable with it from the kind of fan point of view. I mean, I've seen talk of people saying, oh, I'm not going to go to Wimbledon this year because of this, you know, this policy. Do you think that is plausible? Do you think fans will boycott, similar to, you know, we've already heard chatter about a player boycott? Again, not sure how much truth there is in that, but could you see fans also being, you know, feeling so strong about this that, you know, if they have tickets for Wimbledon this year and they don't agree with what Wimbledon has done, do you think they will feel strong enough to be like, actually, you can have your tickets because I don't agree with your decision?
Possibly. I don't think it would make a significant impact on ticket numbers. I think someone would have to be incredibly against it. I mean, I think, like, I'm still going to try and go to Wimbledon, even if I don't necessarily think it was the right, I don't want to say right, but I, you know, even if I'm not so comfortable with the decision, I'm still going to go. You know, sorry if you are a fan of Rublev, you won't be able to see him play. Plenty of other players in the draw. I mean, it affects what I think two of the top 20, oh, sorry, three of the top 20 in singles for the women, two of the top 10 men. I think, I mean, here's another argument. Would any of them have won the title anyway? Probably not in the singles, but I think there could have been some doubles or junior champions, you know, from the
Sabalenka. I mean, necessarily, you know, it's not, I don't think it's a long stretch, you know, to plausibly think about. I was sort of thinking initially when I heard the news that Daniil Medvedev chose the wrong part of the season to have his operation.
It's surgery.
I'm sure talk will rumble on and it'll feature again in the podcast soon. But let's move on, Kim, because we do have other news to talk about, and we do have some British news. Andy Murray has reversed his decision to skip the clay court season. He has taken a wild card into the Madrid Open. Still not sure, still feels doubtful that he will play at the French Open, but positive signs, I feel, that he's decided to take a wild card. I mean, I think he, I personally think he's seen how Novak Djokovic has come back, given, you know, his lack of time on court, and he's thinking, I just can't take this part of the season off and then expect to come back and do the business on the grass season. I still need to keep the engine going. And I think maybe that potentially influenced his decision, along with Evan Lendl, of course.
Yeah, possibly. But then I'm thinking, well, if he's drawn against someone top in the first round, loses, he might just get like, what, two matches if he plays like two tournaments, in which case, is it really worth it? You know, if he goes on a bit of a run and has, you know, some great match practice, fine. But based on what he's been doing in recent tournaments, I'm just not really convinced this is a good idea. You know, if he was really wanting to focus on the grass, I think it would just make more sense to train for longer on the grass.
I don't agree with that. I think he needs match time. I just don't think he can just turn up and be ready to get like and be ready to go. I'd love for that to be the case, but if his body's going to let him play on the clay, and based on videos we've seen on social media, he's looking, you know, he's looking comfortable, he's looking good, then I feel like he's just like, I just don't want to sit around and, you know, wait for this, you know, all to go by, particularly, you know, when time is scarce, particularly on the tour at his age. For me, it was a little bit of a no-brainer.
I just feel like if you're not going to play the French Open, is it sort of, not that everything has to build up to a slam, but it almost reminds me of Federer last year when he like pulled out of the French because he then wanted to focus on Wimbledon. And that like annoyed a lot of people. And this isn't really a direct equation, but it's almost like, oh, I'll just play a bit here and there. But I don't know. I just kind of, it's gone. I think it's just because he's done a bit of a U-turn. But he's obviously got this wild card. I mean, who doesn't want to go to Madrid? There's some great food in Madrid.
Well,
so
the Spanish players did not want him to go to Madrid, it sounded like, or at least they were not happy with his allocation of a wild card. The Madrid Open is now run by IMG, who've had a much greater influence in terms of who gets the wild cards, and as a result, it has sort of minimized kind of local Spanish players' involvement from kind of previous editions, where it just felt like Spanish players were just getting handed all the wild cards to the Madrid Open left, right and center. So players like Fernando Verdasco have kind of come out in sort of anger, saying, yeah, just not happy that kind of local representation has been diminished so significantly because of the change in tournament owners. I mean, do you think that's fair, or do you think, you know, if they own the tournament, they can do what they want? They don't have to pander to kind of local players if they don't feel like it's in their best interest.
Yeah, it's difficult to argue because they, you know, they own the tournament, they can do what they like. Wildcards are in their inherent nature is that they are wild and can go anywhere. But I think looking at the list, it seems they've kind of given more of the qualifying wildcards to Spaniards still. And it's just like the main draw ones that have gone. Well, I think there's only one Spaniard, Carlos Jimeno. Is that Jimeno Travers? I think so. Yeah, only one Spanish player for the main draw. I guess it just kind of go. You shouldn't also, if you're a local like Spanish player who was relying on this, you shouldn't expect to receive one just because you are
a local
of that
player
country, because you do also need to have warranted it.
This isn't the UK back in 2006 at Wimbledon time.
What, where everyone under the sun was getting a wild card?
Yeah,
it's like you do have to earn it as well. And obviously, they've given wild cards to like Naomi Osaka. I mean, obviously, they're going to want her there if she's up for playing. Mm. Andy Murray, you know, big champion. So you can't argue with the sense of like the reasoning behind giving those players wild cards. And I can also see why they've given wild cards to the other players like Fruvertova, Monica Puig, you know. So yeah, it's I get both sides of the argument, to be honest. I think I can see it from both perspectives, but there's no written rule about where wildcards should go. So
do you think there should?
I think a balance is good. Maybe 50-50. 50% Spanish, 50% whoever IMG want. That would be maybe a fairer way to do it going forwards, to appease both sides.
Yeah, no, it's definitely interesting. It's definitely got the Spanish players talking. But what else has got everyone talking is Kim Ashbarty, recently retired world number one. She has signed up for a golf event, the Icons Series, which I think is out in New Jersey in the United States. I was just reading up on it. It's just basically a bunch of celebrities. Not celebrities. Famous sports stars, Pep Guardiola, Michael Phelps, Ash Barty, they're all going to be there. It's a USA versus rest of the world format. But yeah, for tennis fans, does this give us a little bit of an insight in terms of Ash Barty and where she thinks her immediate future might be? Professional in a third sport?
Apparently she plays with a handicap of 5, which, I mean, I don't know much about golf, but that sounds pretty good. I think she's been playing and winning local competitions to where she lives, and her fiance is a golfer, so I guess golf is a big part of her life as a result of that.
I was reading she actually lives on a golf course, and as soon as I read that, I was like, what a traitor to tennis. Shouldn't you be living like next to have a tennis court in the garden? I was just like, that's just complete blasphemy in my book.
I'm picturing like a rabbit burrow or something under one of the like holes. I'm thinking, what, just a house by like the hole. I don't know much about golf, as you can tell. Yeah, I mean, she's obviously just got such a good eye for sports. Like, she's played cricket, she's played tennis professionally. Why not golf? I mean, Rafa likes a bit of golf. A lot of players do play it in their spare time. So it's probably a natural combination as well. Good eyes. But well, we wish her well, see how she gets on. and who doesn't want to play golf with Michael Phelps? I mean, that would be quite fun, wouldn't it?
Pretty all-star pairing, isn't it?
Yes. Right, let's quickly look at what's happening this week, Joel. We've got Estoril and we've also got Munich. So two ATP 250 events out on the clay. Felix Auger-Aliassime is headlining Estoril, but Davidovich Fokina is there, who's potentially looking more likely to come through the top half, given his exploits in Monte Carlo. Seb Korda's there. Dominic Thiem again, having a crack at this one. Schwartzman, Marin Cilic is the third seed. That's interesting. Ramos Vinolas is there, though, as well. He's the defending champion. And then Zverev is out in Munich with Casper Ruud and Basilashvili, who's the defending champion there. So any initial thoughts on these draws?
Yeah, I think I will be looking at Davidovich Fokina. I think he cited fatigue and dropped out last week after his exploits in Monte Carlo. So I'll be curious to see how he comes back in Estoril in a 250. And yeah, Dominic Thiem as well. I thought Dominic Thiem looked all right, in his first match, back since injury, given how much, time he's been off court. He's got Benjamin Bonzi in the first round, and then could potentially face Sebi Korda. So, I'm sort of, curious to see how he gets on as well. In Munich, yeah, I think Casper Ruud. I quite like Casper Ruud. Zverev might be looking at this as an opportunity for him to win his first tour title this season. Dan Evans is there. I mean, Dan Evans had a not great start to the clay season. He's got Maxime Cressy in the first round. So, I'm sort of thinking Ruud. Yeah, Ruud maybe in Munich. And I think maybe Davidovich Fokina. I think he'll just ride that energy, that momentum from Monte Carlo, and see where it takes him potentially to another title.
Yeah, for sure. I think he's the one I'm intrigued by the most from Estoril. And as for Munich, yeah, see what Dan Evans can get up.
Philip Kohlschreiber is there.
Is he still going? Yeah, is he still? He's there in a while. Still around.
I know. Amazing.
He's got Daniel Altmaier in the first round. And I see there's another German wild card. See, well, they're obviously giving their wild cards to locals. I've actually been to both these tournaments. I remember when I went to Munich, it was absolutely freezing cold. My toes were like ice. So I hope they have better weather this week. But we'll be back next week to catch up on all of the action from both of those events.
Yes, listeners, I hope you enjoyed listening to this latest catch-up of The Passing Shot. Remember to subscribe to us to stay up to date on the ATP and WTA tours on whatever device you listen to us on. We are on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcasting platforms out there. You can also listen to us on the DownloadTennis.com app. And if you like what you're hearing, then make sure to leave us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
And you can follow us on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We are at Passing Shot Pod. So do give us a like and a follow if you don't already. But you can also get in contact via email if you prefer, passingshotpod@gmail.com. And don't forget to check out our website, www.thepassingshot.co.uk.
And we will be back next week at Passing Shot HQ for another tour catch-up. So I hope you can join us for our next episode. But in the meantime, it's goodbye from Kim.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. We will see you again soon.